Anyhow, let's go back to lenvatinib, pembrolizumab. I'm curious what your thoughts are. I always like to ask people about this, about what's going on in terms of mechanism of action. Why is it that an anti-angiogenic, you see it with an antibody like Bev, you see it with TKI like with lenvatinib. Any thoughts about what's going on there with the IO?
Yeah, it's a great question. The short answer is I don't think we know. And we sort of got into it, I mean, not to be too shrill about it, but we got into it almost sort of on an empiric basis because agents like Bev and then the IO were available. So people reflexively say, hey, these are two good combinations to throw in, and they're not going to have overlapping toxicities. But as I said in my presentation, I do think there are some rationale for that. So for instance, certainly the anti-VEGF therapies, VEGF is a very immunosuppressive agent. And I think we're going to find out that it's even more immunosuppressive than we appreciated. That doesn't apply to too much to lenvatinib because lenvatinib is working on the receptor level, which is sort of downstream. But you could argue, look at those receptors are sitting on immune cells and the VEGF is interacting. And so it's blocking those. And so maybe it's blocking immune suppressive signals to the T cells. You can't really see me on the screen. I'm waving my hands right now. So there's a certain amount of unknown factors here. But the bottom line is they're off and running. We did the phase two trial, single agent of lenvatinib when I was at Harvard. It's an interesting drug. It certainly does have some toxicities. It has a very unusual toxicity in that it can produce significant weight loss. And the weight loss is from appetite suppression. In addition to fatigue, hypertension, and some diarrhea, it does have this unusual weight loss phenomenon, which appears to be an essential toxicity because patients just don't want to eat.
So, you know, it's incredible how many times I've asked people about lenvatinib going back to the HCC days and never heard anybody, even thyroid, I think, never heard anybody bring up the loss of appetite. That is really interesting. Incidentally, are they looking into that as a treatment for obesity or something?
It's interesting. So first of all, one of the reasons that we may have seen more of it in the phase one/phase two single agent is we went to higher doses. But two, yeah, I actually brought that up a couple of times with a little tongue in cheek, but I think the company's put that on the back burner for now, but not crazy. I've not ever dealt with a drug that had that phenomenon. I had a lovely, lovely patient of mine who was kind of a small, demurring lady who was on single agent for endometrial cancer and was on it for over 2 years, swore by the drug and wouldn't come off. She literally begged me and she lost 30% of her body weight and then finally came off. And it was amazing. Within 3 months, she gained it all back.
Wow. 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 How many times have you seen what you thought was, I mean, I don't know how many times you've even used lenvatinib, but how many times have you seen this phenomenon of the loss of appetite?
Well, in the single agent trial, we saw 30% to 40%.
Wow.
In the combination, we're not seeing it as much. But again, if you look at some of the numbers I presented, the 20 milligram is tough to deal with. I start with 20 milligrams because that's what the FDA approved, and I don't have a problem with. A lot of my colleagues are starting at 14 and going up if they can. I start at 20 and work down. The average dose on that trial ended up to being around 14 milligrams. So it may be that when you're down in that range, you're seeing some hypertension, some diarrhea, but you're not seeing a lot of the appetite suppression.
Yeah, I just got really, I was about to ask you about a bunch of the other stuff, and I got really diverted when you told me about this weight loss thing. That do the patients complain of it? Do they not like it? I mean, what do they actually say? Do they stop eating completely? It's not a dysgeusia, right?
Correct. That's right. You know, frankly, if I recall correctly, on the phase two single agent, they didn't really complain about it. We noticed it from the clinical trial standpoint because weight loss is actually an adverse event. And so you have to quantify this stuff. But it's not like they're nauseous. It's not like they feel uncomfortable. They just don't feel like eating. So,
Amazing.
yeah.
How does hypertension with this combination actually play out? Do you see symptomatic patients? Is it just that it's hard to control on paper?
Yeah, I think part of that is drug related, and part of it a little bit is what I would call the lay of the land for oncology. If you remember, gynecologic cancers are a little different in that they, a lot of our patients are treated both by med-oncs and by gyn-oncs. In the med-onc field, we've been using TKIs. They've been approved quite a bit. And so the hypertension, the fatigue associated with it is something that we've seen and we deal with. It's a little bit newer in gyn-onc. And so I think that that's part of the equation. And that's changing rapidly because a lot of people are using the combination. And as gyn-oncs get comfortable with it, that'll be fine. But the second issue is the drug itself, which is that we're used to hypertension from Bev, right? You give the antibody. The bad news is the antibody has a long half-life. So if you get hypertension, it hangs around for a while. But the good news is it comes on slower. It's rare they have a patient call you up and say, I got a splitting headache and I'm seeing things and I'm in a hypertensive crisis. It's just, if you're on top of your patients, it doesn't happen. For lovatinib, you can see severe hypertension within 48 to 72 hours. Part of it is probably mechanism of action. Part of it is absorption of the drug and how it gets in very quickly. The good news is, because it's an oral drug, if you hold a drug, it disappears fast. But I do know my colleagues, I'm thinking several of them at Memorial, have just felt that for patients who already have hypertension or patients who don't, but they're concerned one, they'll actually prescribe either a beta blocker or a calcium channel blocker at the time they start them on lovatinib and Pembro, and then they'll do the usual, take your blood pressure at home. So when they get the call saying, yeah, you know, I'm 170 over 110, they don't have to call in a prescription, just say, okay, start the medication. So I find that perfectly acceptable. I'll do it as a reaction, but you got to be aware of this stuff. If you ask the patients what they complain about on lovatinib, you make a good point. Hypertension is something we worry about. They don't really complain too much. It's frankly the diarrhea, because it just makes them uncomfortable. It's about 35% of patients below 10% is grade 3. That makes them feel uncomfortable. And the fatigue is also an issue that they don't like.
Yeah. I don't remember hearing about diarrhea with HCC, but I did, you know, because initially I was like, well, do people feel bad when they get it? And then I started to hear people say, yeah, it's, you know, it's a TKI. They feel fatigued. They have kind of TKI stuff, so to speak. Is that your impression in, let's say, for example, endometrial cancer, when you give lenvatinib pembro, that you're getting some TKI stuff? Do you think that's what the fatigue is?
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, if you look really carefully at the phase 2 trial, if you look at discontinuation rates and you ascribe it to drugs, it turns out the discontinuation rate for lovatinib is about the same as pembro. But if you look at the dose interruption, it's twice as high for lovatinib. So what does that tell you? It tells you that they're getting a reaction to it. They don't like it. They get some hypertension, diarrhea. You hold a drug, you adjust the dose, and you're fine. And the discontinuation rate, meaning the really serious stuff, is about the same for both drugs.
I think the other thing that I was trying to figure out is it kind of is sounding like whatever toxicity you get from Pembro, you get it, like any other situation. Whatever toxicity from lovatinib, you're getting it. It sounds like maybe there's no synergy between the toxicities. You just deal with them separately, sort of. Or do you think there's actually some synergistic toxicity going on?
Yeah, great question. I don't think there is. I think it's true and unrelated. The only part that's somewhat related is a clinical management standpoint. When you get the diarrhea, right, you've got to make sure that you're dealing with lovatinib-induced diarrhea and not colitis from the Pembro, because the ramifications of that is really quite different. And so I usually score it in terms of severity, and of course I look for blood. And anything that suggests continued diarrhea holding lovatinib or bloody diarrhea, then they go to a scope and you're looking at potentially a Pembro-induced problem. But I think you're absolutely right. I don't see synergistic interactions or toxicities. And I think a lot of it has been a learning curve in terms of how do you handle this, because it's been a new experience. But remember, this is the irony on this. What was our drug of choice prior to the development of this regimen? It was doxorubicin. You want to give adriamycin to an obese, diabetic, hypertensive woman. Not easy. And the response rate was considerably lower. So this is a huge step forward, even with the toxicities.
Yeah, it's really amazing being in CME, you know, topics that we couldn't find anything to talk about, like bladder cancer. Bladder cancer. They got two novel agents approved. Bladder cancer, you know, so interesting times.